Washington, D.C. Let's begin, Cynthia Roseberry, with you. Talk about the people who were just granted clemency.
Sure. Many of them were convicted under draconian drug laws. And I would say that Clemency Project 2014 is not limited to drug offenders, but most of those laws have changed now. So this initiative gave hope to people who never thought they'd be reunited with their families, who were given life sentences or very long sentences for nonviolent offenses.
Now, talk about the significance of what President Obama is doing. And did you work with the White House in choosing the names of the people who would get clemency?
No, we're wholly separate from the White House. We are an initiative of the American Bar Association, the American Civil Liberties Union, Families Against a Mandatory Minimum, National Public and Community Defenders, and the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. So we work wholly independently of the White House, but we screen applicants. We have more than 30,000 now to see if they appear to qualify under the president's initiative, and then we send those petitions over to the pardon attorney.
Reynolds Winter-Smith, tell us your story, having once faced life in prison for selling crack. But talk about what the clemency that President Obama granted you or the commutation of your sentence, what it means.
Well, to me, what it meant, it gave me another chance at life to build upon this part of my life in the presence. You know, I'm thankful for it. It made me realize that even when we have the possibility of failure in front of us, that doesn't mean that we should give up hope. We should continue to strive, make it easier for a person that wants to give you a second chance. And I'm thankful for it.
Can you talk about the sentencing for nonviolent drug offenders like yourself?
Yes. Well, first, I would like to say that I believe in law and order. I believe in structure. So I understand the effects that it had on the community, on the lives of the people. But far as sentencing, when you come before a judge and he passes out a sentence to you, the only thing that you will hope for is to have a fairness in it, a balance. And a lot of times with the drug sentences, there's no balance. When I got sentenced in 1994, November, it was no extraordinary circumstances that they could bring up because of the sentencing guidelines. They were mandatory at the time. So it was just numbers computed and implemented, and I was given a sentence of life in 40 years for count one conspiracy and then a count four that was on the conspiracy. So, I mean, with this new criteria that President Obama has set forth for clemency, it has made it possible for people to reach forward, to believe that they can have another chance. As we all know, that the backlog of clemency positions runs into tens of thousands.
Reynolds, how did you get the clemency? You'd already been in jail for, what, like 18 years?
Yes. Well, the process began long before I even filed paperwork. I worked for a lady in the education department. Her name was Janice Feaster. I was a tutor. And, we had dialogue. And a guy, Pryor Reed, President Bush had pardoned him. He had a life sentence. He had been in prison for 8 years. And so when she told me what happened with him, because he worked with us as a leadership library clerk, she told me that, why don't you file for clemency? Your story is a different kind of story. And, at the time, facing all the things from my own past and still being held accountable for it, it was hard for me to see why would they give me another chance. I had faced issues in prison, such as classes. Okay. And so it was a process. I'm glad that I had a great support group. And then I had an attorney, my angel Cody, that said, yes, she would help me.
Well, we will continue to follow what happens this week with President Obama being the first sitting president to visit a prison, that in Oklahoma. Reynolds Winter-Smith and Cynthia Roseberry, thanks so much for being with us. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alcock, Hani Massoud, Robbie Caron, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is Donna with your WUSB Concert Billboard. Your Concert Billboard for Wednesday, July 15th. Danny Keene will be at the Sugar Bar, Manhattan, 5 p.m. Eastbound Freight will be at the Port Jefferson Village Center, 6:30. Gene Casey and the Loan Sharks will be at Silversmith's Corner, in cell hold, 7:30. Toad the Wet Sprocket will be at the Paradise in Huntington Village, 8 p.m. The Ghost of the Sabertooth Tiger with Sean Lennon will be at the Brooklyn Bowl, 8:30. Your WUSB Concert Billboard for Thursday, July 16th. Rachel Platten will be at Shorefront Park in Patchogue, 6:30. Howard will be at the Surf Lodge in Montauk, 7 p.m. Colby Pillay and Christina Perry will be at Shorefront Park in Patchogue, beginning at 7. Salt and Pepper will be at B.B. King's, Manhattan, at 8. Hoodoo Loungers will be at the Port Jefferson Village Center.
Concert Billboard. I love Concert Billboard. I'm Mr. Edison, host of No Apologies, one of the hosts of Jazz on the Air, and thanks for listening to WUSB.
Well, it is the 6:02 on a Tuesday evening, and of course, that can only mean one thing. It's time for Off the Wall, right here on WUSB, Stony Brook. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you. Tonight, we will be voyaging to Austria as we play a program that was taped in Salzburg this January. We start with some commentary on a rather unusual intersection that Kyle and I discovered while walking around the streets. And then we'll play some excerpts from a really cool radio station over there called Radio Fabrique. And you'll also hear an entire interview that we did at that radio station. Excerpts of it were aired on Radio Fabrique, and we are happy to present the entire thing to you here tonight. We'll also close the program with another excerpt from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg. Enjoy. So, Kyle, we're standing at this intersection in Salzburg, and we're about to hear kind of interesting sound.
Oh, Manuel, it's you.
Yeah, it's me.
I didn't recognize. Hi, how you doing?
I'm kind of perplexed a little bit because this is something I think I know what it is. We're at an intersection. It's at night, but It's basically a three-way intersection, right, with a walk and don't walk sign and a green, red light and all that.
These are very involved lights. I mean, there's like a cable holding one arm of a thing.
Now it's flashing green. Now it's turned red. And okay, the green light is flashing. It's about to turn yellow. And then red. Yellow. And now red. Yeah, did you hear that? Did you hear that sound?
Wait, it sounded like a bell.
It was a bell. There, if you look, you see there's a bell above that traffic light.
You're right.
And we noticed this walking around Salzburg here in Austria a couple days ago, actually a day ago. And it's going to do it again when the light changes back, I think. Hang on, here it goes. It didn't do it that time. Why didn't it do it that time? All right. I think it only does it in one way. I thought it did it the other way, though. Go ahead.
No, the important thing is we're learning. This is a new development. You know, I don't think we realized that about this. But now, at least we know that it's directional. There's only one situation where it does occur. But it is a bell, and it is corresponding with the light.
Well, the green man is flashing again. Now the green light is flashing. Now it's yellow. It's about to turn red. Hang on. Yeah.
That's fairly predictable.
It's predictable now. But I thought it went... I thought the bell went off when it changed back, but I could just be wrong about that. So anyway, what I think this is, I think this harkens back to the days before actual traffic lights existed, when it was just basically like a stop sign that kind of, it was like a flag that sort of was thrown out. And you heard what that car did, right? That was in eco mode.
Yeah, eco mode.
Eco mode.
Eco mode.
That's where a car starts up again. At a light, because it turns off. Anyway, so the bell, I think, and someone please correct me, and I know you will correct me if I'm wrong, before there were traffic lights, there were bells, and basically that's how you knew when the light changed, because it wasn't yet a light, it was a bell. And I think they just might have kept this here over the years.
I don't know. I have doubts.
Well, do you want to tell me the point of this annoying noise?
No, because...
I'm sorry. Were you annoyed by being interrupted by the bell?
Pardon me. No, I just think it doesn't look that old.
Well, I'm sure they replaced it and maintained it and things like that, but it's an historical thing. Maybe this is the first intersection in the world.
And that bell is representing the first traffic light ever. Or a walk crossing signal ever.
See, you say that sarcastically, but I think that could be the case. Or maybe the first one in Austria, maybe the first one in Salzburg. I don't know, but why else would you put a bell on top of a traffic light? It makes no sense. And, you know, I'll tell you, there's buildings here, apartment buildings. People seem to be really annoyed. At least I would be.
I don't see anybody looking too annoyed. But it's definitely an interesting system. We got, like, red now for the crossing guy. If I might just interrupt here.
You're going to be interrupted in a second.
No, I just want to say...
Imagine that. All night long. Every time the light changes. And you live across the street from that. Imagine.
Yeah. And, you know, we were noticing other ones that have the cuckoo, the...
Well, yeah, we've talked... the clicking. We've talked about that. But that's handy. That's for blind people. I don't know how this would benefit blind people.
Yeah, I think blind people would feel like they got the short end of the deal on this. I mean, it's not that helpful.
Well, you do know when the light changes, but you don't know which way the light just changed. I guess, since it only seems to change one way, you learn pretty quickly. Anyway, it's freezing cold. I just wanted to point that out as we were walking by, because who knows when we'll see something like this again. But if any old-timers are out there and they know something about bells, alarm bells on traffic intersections or whatever, maybe you could write to us and let us know.
Yeah, and, gosh, it's... I don't know, just sort of an interesting observation.
See? Yeah, we have a time just right.
Yeah, I think we're getting this down.
it be good to have a lighting on the wall, a lighting on.
Die Straßenzeitung für Salzburg.
Kostet wenig, bringt viel.
Thema dieser Ausgabe:
Für immer jung.
Und das steht drin:
Engagierte Jugendliche. Titelinterview mit der 16-jährigen Kinderrechtspreisträgerin Hodan Hashi. Midlife Crisis. Liegen die besten Zeiten mit 40 wirklich hinter einem? Jugendträume. Apropos Verkäuferinnen, erinnere sich an ihre Kindheit.
Apropos, die Straßenzeitung für Salzburg. Journalistische Vielfalt.
Einzigartige Themen.
Lesestoff für jedermann.
Und jede Frau.
Die Radiofabrik. Freies Radio für Salzburg.
Test, Test, Check, 1, 2, 1, 2.
Die Radiofabrik von 1 bis 2, das freie Radio für Salzburg auf 107,5 MHz.
What are you doing in Salzburg and Europe?
Well, a lot of people ask us that question. What are you doing here? Why are you here? Kyle and I travel in various places of the world looking into things related to hackers, things related to technology, radio, just overall adventure. So you never know where we're going to wind up next. We just kind of go from place to place.
On this trip, we were planning sort of a big loop to a lot of different places that we hadn't been before. And it turned out that, you had been to Slovakia before, but it wasn't Slovakia. And a previous trip, a couple years ago, we went to every former Yugoslavian republic. So it was really cool to start out in Prague and then see Slovakia as well and then make our way back around.
Yeah, I had been in Bratislava once before, but not Slovakia because it was Czechoslovakia then. And now we basically sort of did a little loop. We went through Dresden, down to Prague, over to Bratislava, Budapest, and then over to, where were we just before? I lost track. Vienna, yes, and now Salzburg. And we're going to keep going through Germany again.
It's really important to us to see like the differences and how some of these places have changed, and they are changing right now. I hadn't been to any of these places in my travels so far, so it's pretty exciting for me to be in new places like Austria and And then I guess going back to Germany here shortly. So it's been kind of a long couple of weeks just checking out everything that's new and trying to meet and collaborate, network, see who's out there, see what people are doing.
It all started at the Chaos Congress in Hamburg back in December. That's the annual meeting of hackers from all around the world, and I think about 12,000 people showed up this year. And then after that, we just kind of went on a tour exploring other hacker spaces and seeing what people are up to there and just making a lot of interesting connections.
So you're both attending conferences and trying to meet up with local hacker communities, so to say?
Well, it's something that we do occasionally. We do have that interest, so we're always following things that are happening in the news involving technology, involving hackers. So, and we also know a lot of people in these areas, so it's good to kind of make those contacts, see what people are up to. We were in a hackerspace, where was that, in Dresden, where they were working with radioactive material, which was kind of, was that Dresden?
No, you're talking about Prague. Yeah, Brum Lab, BRM Lab.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm getting all, we should write this down. But yeah, Prague, it was an amazing place. They were doing such serious work, and you forget sometimes that hacker spaces are so wide open to innovation of all sorts.
Yeah, many different disciplines and interesting projects. And but as kind of awe-inspiring as that can be, there's a lot of kind of regular everyday things that we deal with a lot in the U.S., like growth issues, social dynamics, things that the community has to address. You know, you have to tackle some of the problems of this to move on. So it was very, very natural, I think. We're often kind of blown away by the variety of projects and momentum, but there's also things insofar as the space is growing, practical things like the building got sold and we have to find a new venue, or we're running out of room, so we have to get more space in this venue. And I think in Bratislava at Progress Bar, getting people excited about a new space that is really full of potential, but maybe people are just busy, the will isn't there. So it's really cool to see how much people, a lot of the people there aspire to continue to grow, to build, but they also have their own challenges. And to us, that's very realistic. That is familiar. We deal with a lot of challenges just in our own communities back in the States.
So now I have a very obvious question for you. We usually get probably a wrong image of hackers from Hollywood and the media. Can you tell us what is a hacker? What does it mean to you?
Well, how much time do you have? I can go on for a very long time about that. And basically, a hacker is somebody who just is constantly experimenting, questioning, trying new things, testing the boundaries, breaking things, fixing things, building things. It's really it's individual achievement. It's all sorts of different bits of technology, and sometimes not even technology itself. A journalist, for instance, is a hacker because they're always questioning what they're being told, and they're always looking for the exception. They're always looking for a way to find out what it is they want to know, despite being told no many, many times. So in that way, I think every kid in the world is also a hacker. They've got that hacker mentality to a degree until it gets programmed out of them at some point and they wind up being conformists. What we see in Hollywood, what we see in the media, is a demonization, because that's necessary for them to sell papers, to make movies, to get people to panic when they need to panic. And basically a way of controlling the populace by creating this demon known as hackers, who can do anything with computers, who can steal your identity, who can turn off your electricity, and virtually anything is possible in their minds. I don't think they really believe it. I think they know that it's a load of crap what they're peddling, but it does sell the papers. It does get people to tune in, gets people to go to the movies. In reality, what the hacker world is, it's a lot more open, it's a lot more friendly, it's a lot more inviting to anybody that wants to learn. A good hacker is somebody who will always teach, always share information, not somebody who keeps it to themselves or sells it for a profit or anything like that. But you would never find that out from the media, from the people in control.
Yeah, we kind of appeal to like the most virtuous attributes of hacking. There's obviously exceptions. There's people that do a lot of things in the name of hacking, and of course the media is right there to label it hacking, even if no one involved was arguing that to begin with. Maybe they had no idea what hacking was. They're just using tools or technology that a hacker might be familiar with. But we really we know that there is sort of there's a bigger goal in mind. There's a bigger sort of ethos that I think real hackers get. They align themselves with that. They want to teach. They want to learn. And there's all kinds of little stories on the side and in between, but the broader concept is really a good thing and something that I think is pretty well mainstream now, and I think the rest of the world, actual people and actual media and teachers alike, I think they get it. They understand what they're capable of and what their intentions actually are.
We've been publishing a hacker magazine now for 31 years, so we've been fighting this fight for a long time, and the media has never gotten it. And the population of people out there that have no conception of what computers do, what technology is all about, or tell themselves that anyway, because I think everyone has the ability to learn, they are being led around and given an image that is just basically inaccurate, and hackers have always been seen as a threat. But back in the early days, when we were publishing our magazine, it wasn't like it was today. People were afraid of hackers, but it wasn't to the extent where you actually, other than in your wildest fantasies, would think of them as starting wars or working for governments or stealing people's identities or all the things that are being associated with them right now. And I think if you investigate each of those stories that are being told by the media, you'll find there is no connection with hackers. People might be using abilities that hackers figured out. A hacker might be able to figure out, hey, this operating system has no password, and it's easy to get into and download things because of that. Well, the next person that comes along, hearing what the hacker had to say, and does exactly that, downloads something because there's no password, that person's not a hacker. That person is simply listening to what was told to them by a hacker, and they're using the ability that the hacker has demonstrated for them. Meanwhile, the people running the system have done nothing to secure it, and it's really on them to keep their systems secure and private. That's where we've seen the failings. We've seen phone companies, credit card companies, banks. They're the ones that leave their customer data out there for everybody to see. It's the hackers who get blamed for their oversights, for their insecurity, as far as just leaving information out there unencrypted. When hackers discover this, they usually tell everybody, but then they get the blame as well.
So if I understand you well, being a hacker is not about what you do, but about your state of mind?
It is a state of mind, for sure. It's about what you're interested in. If you're interested in testing the system and doing something over and over again with minute changes until you get a different result, that is a form of hacking. Exploration is a form of hacking as well. Questioning is a form of hacking. So it is what you do to a degree, but it is most definitely a state of mind.
Yeah, in the purest form, it's what your actions obviously do. They do say a lot about your ethos and what you stand for, certainly. But it's also in its purest form a sort of a positive thing, something that is not necessarily in order to share secrets or to do something for profit, right? In a pure form, it's somebody who's persistent, who wants to solve a problem, for the sake of solving that problem. People use the tools and they kind of, as I said, do things under the auspices of hacking, but in a lot of those cases, it's also industrial espionage, or it's actual criminal behavior and stuff like that, and it gets very often conflated. So, as I said, we really try to appeal to the positive ethos. And I
remember one of the early letters that we printed in 2600, somebody was asking the question as to whether they thought they were a hacker or whether their friends were actually hackers. And I remember the answer we printed was basically, if a lot of people think you're wasting your time, then you're probably a hacker. But if there are all these people gathered around you wanting you to give them information so that they could rip somebody off, then you're probably a criminal. That's the difference. If you're just interested in finding out something for the sake of curiosity or to learn how it works, not a lot of other people that don't share those interests will be interested in that. They won't be following you. But that is really what it comes down to, is just basically focusing on something that you want to know the answer to and not giving up till you get it.
You've been busy with internet and hacking and information technology for over 30 years. How can you describe the changes in the internet? Today the internet looks somehow like a battlefield. There are government, there are terrorists, there are different groups acting on the internet. There are private companies. How does it look like? Who is against whom? And
well, I mean, it's changed more than you could possibly imagine anything changing in the last 30 years or so. I mean, 30 years ago, there really wasn't an internet. There was the ARPANET, the beginnings of the internet, but nothing like this. We saw it start up as an educational institution, something that basically grew to include everybody, and then we saw the rampant commercialization of the internet. And now we're seeing fragmentation, which kind of brought it back to the way it used to be before the internet, when you had BBSs and all different phone numbers you would call that were isolated from each other. Well, now you have Facebook, you know, now you have social media where basically it's self-contained, and there are people who don't use email anymore. They only communicate on Facebook. But if you don't communicate on Facebook, you can't talk to them. If you don't communicate on Twitter, you can't talk to those people. So we're kind of seeing the internet rise into something that's really amazing as far as being able to communicate with people. But then you see these self-imposed exiles being implemented, where people won't communicate unless a particular protocol is right, or unless you use a certain program. And they're doing that to protect themselves, because there's such widespread surveillance going on. People don't feel safe. But we're also losing what the internet, the promise of the internet, which basically was able to link so many people together. And we still have that. We have not lost that completely. It's just, it's not being used to its full potential. The power of something like Twitter is simply incredible, especially in crisis situations where you see all kinds of things being spread around. It's the nightmare of every government on earth, as is freedom of speech. There is no government that would not want to watch all of its citizens, and the internet is something that makes that rather difficult. But they are constantly working on ways, as Edward Snowden has pointed out, to thwart that, to be able to monitor everybody. And with every unfortunate event that takes place in the world, every war, every act of terrorism, they will take advantage of that. Whether it has anything at all to do with surveillance or not, they will argue that they need to spy on us more to protect us. And that's something we really have to watch out for, because that goes a lot further than destroying the internet. That is destroying our way of life.
Yeah, I think recently British Prime Minister David Cameron said that he wanted to oppose encrypted messaging apps such as WhatsApp and Snapchat.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a perfect example. The recent events in Paris had nothing to do with encrypted messages or anything like that. These people simply weren't being watched when they should have been watched. Intelligent surveillance is the important thing, not mass surveillance. Watching everybody does not make us safer. Figuring out who the dangerous people are and watching them, that does. And there were plenty of signals, plenty of evidence that these people should have been watched, and they were not. And that's the unfortunate thing. Now, what Cameron has done is latched on to the feelings of fear and anger, and is trying to convince people that, well, we need to be able to read everything that you write in order to protect you. And there are a fair number of people, particularly those who are not technical in nature, who will buy that, because they won't know that it's a load of garbage what he's saying to them. And that's what we have to really beware of. One thing, I've brought this up in the past, if it was possible to read brainwaves, they would say, we have to be able to read your brainwaves, because if we can't do that, we can't protect you. We don't have the means to know what you're thinking, so we can't protect you from people who are thinking bad things and will do bad things. Once you give up a right, whether it's reading your brainwaves, reading your mail, reading whatever, you will never get that back. They will never give that up. So it's just something to think about. Ask yourself, was this necessary 30 years ago? And if it was not, then it's probably not necessary today.
Speaking of giving up rights, when the internet started, it was more of an anonymous place, if I'm not mistaken. It was not common to be on the internet with your real identity. And now real identities and virtual identities are more and more connected. And governments start being afraid of the possibility of being anonymous. Do you think anonymity is more a threat or a value? And how can we protect our anonymity?
Well, anonymity is a right. It's not a threat in any sense. It's something that enables free speech. People speaking without identifying themselves is a time-honored tradition. Anonymous tips, for instance, for journalists, or just somebody being able to say something controversial without having to pay the penalty, without people close to them finding out, or just basically creating a new persona for yourself that's different than something that you've lived with all your life. It's extremely important, and we've seen something called memoirs over the past few years, where people are being pressured to not use aliases such as on Google or on Facebook or various other social media sites. And it's something that organizations like Electronic Frontier Foundation are fighting, because the right to be anonymous is an important right. It's not synonymous with crime, as is being portrayed by those that fear anonymity. It's a vital, extremely important part of free speech.
Yeah, we have to look at the cost and benefit. Like, you really lose quite a bit to maybe get some tiny result from outlawing anonymity or removing it. It is far better, far more beneficial to society to have the ability to be anonymous, whether it's whistleblowing or writing a letter, you know, to an editor in a station or a newspaper or any kind of publication. You lose so much with that, and it would be far worse, I think, than anything that would happen. I mean, because real crimes, whether it's on the internet or an action someone does violently, those things are detectable. Those things you can investigate intelligently. You don't need, if there's something that has been done to obscure it, to maybe make it something that you need to investigate, so be it. But that means you're not doing as much work as you should be, though, as investigators. And, crimes have been going on for quite a long time. To try to level the playing field, or call it that even, is a bit silly. It's a bit silly given what you would have to sacrifice.
Yeah, George Orwell wrote in 1984 about every movement of citizens being scrutinized. And that is what we're moving into. We're moving into a society where we're always on video someplace. We're always being tracked by our IP on the internet, or by our cell phones in our pockets. And unless you're up to something, you shouldn't worry, is the feeling of the authorities and of the corporations. Why would you want to hide? Why would you want to be anonymous? Why would you not want to be tracked at all times? We can expect that from them. We can expect that sort of behavior, that sort of abuse of privacy. What annoys me is when people embrace that themselves for the sake of convenience, when they say, okay, you know what, I'll let Google have access to all of my email, knowing that they're reading it, knowing that they're sending me targeted advertising, knowing that they're tracking my movements 24 hours a day, because it's convenient for me. I'm willing to give up my right for privacy, my right for anonymity, my right not to always be in their sights. It's a really, really sad thing when we give that up.
And a lot of these services, what you sign up for is actually the ability for them to infinitely change the terms of the very service you've agreed to. So as soon as you agree to it, the scope and breadth of information they glean from you can change in an instant, and you would not necessarily be reissued. I mean, the most you'd see this is when privacy policies are updated, and even that is something that more or less happens automatically. But there's, and you might see it go by and then, you know, say skip for now if you don't want to read it. But what I've noticed, I mean, just an example, silly things like, you know, using an app for Gmail or something on your phone. In the 1 minute, yeah, you've got the convenience of accessing it, and the user interface is maybe a little better for your device, but then the very next instant, you could accidentally be getting all of your contacts pulled from the phone, and all of a sudden Google is storing them in your contacts and otherwise associating them with your contacts in Gmail. Things like that happen all the time now, and when you subscribe or you know, put all of your eggs, so to speak, in one service, you're eliminating choice in every deliberate action you make on the internet. And this sort of speaks to what we said earlier about the fragmentation of it. And ultimately, my concern is, what kind of users are we creating? And these services themselves are limited. And that is not how I came up learning about the internet. In fact, it was always my goal to learn every port in the TCP/IP protocol. There's a lot of them. We talk about web like it's the only thing the internet can do. It is not. It's not at all. There are a lot of ports to do things on. And it is absolutely hilarious. And I've spent almost a lifetime, half a lifetime trying to use the TCP/IP protocols better and more widely across the board, not just web, not just secure protocols or email on port 20 or whatever. You know, those things are profoundly useful. And when I have the entire breadth of that protocol, I have choice on every single layer of it. But when you just subscribe to a service and you eliminate the other attributes, the other choice you have in that technology, you're allowing that company to choose for you. And every little incremental deliberate choice you get to make is absolutely stripped from you, to the point and to the extent where your service is out of control, right? They change it, and all of a sudden your contacts are associated, and you never ever really wanted that. But somewhere in there, you agreed to it, they change the policy, and all of a sudden it gets pulled from your phone. These things are happening every day, and it's really frightening.
You asked what a hacker was. That was a hacker. That was a hacker. Someone who questions everything that's out there, the decisions being made, somebody who wants to map out every single port. Why? What does he gain from this? It's curiosity. It's knowledge. It's building something better.
You were mentioning companies as Google. Such company have increasingly high technological and economical power. Can they become a threat not only for citizens but also for governments? Can they become out of control?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's certainly possible. But I think that really depends on us as people. Yeah, they're already a threat to governments because they're so powerful. I heard today that Google is investing $1 billion into SpaceX, which I think is great. You know, a private industry in space will get a lot further probably. But what we have to do is always think of massive entities with huge amounts of power, even if they're doing good things, as threats to our individual liberties. Because if we disagree on something, who's going to get their way? The multi-billion dollar corporation or the individual people who are fragmented and disagreeing with each other on all sorts of issues? We have to keep them in check in various ways. At the same time, we have to keep our governments in check because they can abuse our lives in different ways. So it's kind of an uneasy truce that exists when you have these massive entities out there. And it's also, it's bad for competition when everything winds up being owned by the same few corporations. We've seen that time and time again with ISPs and media and all sorts of outlets where competition really seems to be disappearing.
I have one last question for you, or at least one last topic. You made a comparison with Orwell's 1984. I think in that novel, the government is forcing some kind of control on the citizens, while today the citizens are buying such control devices by themselves. I am thinking of this new evolution of the internet, this so-called Internet of the Things, where the objects we own are more and more connected, and they generate a huge amount of data on ourselves. What can you tell us about domotics and wearable computing? And
well, if you want to see what the threat is, all you have to do is see what Edward Snowden has been telling us for the last year and change. The metadata alone tells such a story about us, but that says nothing about what happens with all the new technology that we wind up using and sharing information and giving up all of our data to these marketing firms and to the governments that spy on all of us. It's sad, as I said before, it's sad to see people being at the heart of all this, the ones requesting more surveillance, the ones saying we need more cameras to prevent crime, when it's been proven over and over again that cameras don't prevent crime. They simply move crime. They move crime away from where the cameras are. It creates a suspicious society where we basically think that evil lurks around every corner, and where we are always looking at each other for any semblance of wrongdoing. Somehow, when it comes from a government, you expect that. And it's something that you can fight. It's something that you almost welcome the battle because you have the possibility of winning. But how do you have that possibility of winning when the people advocating this are your friends and your family? Nothing makes me happier than hearing kids saying they don't use Facebook because they know it's a violation of their privacy. They know it's how their teachers or their family or their peers are going to learn things about them that they have no business knowing. These threats exist everywhere in every tool, and we have to think very carefully before we simply dive in and start using it. I love demonstrating to people who accept these things so willingly how much I can find out about them in a relatively short period of time. You can find out what music they're listening to. You can find out where they went on vacation, their pet's name, what their house looks like, things that, you know, in my hands probably isn't much of a threat, but in someone's hands who means them harm could be huge. And do you really want the whole world knowing this? People post their class schedules on the internet. Why would you need for the entire planet to have access to this information? Surely there are bad things that can happen. And privacy is something that we should relish, we should enjoy, we should take pride in knowing that, hey, nobody knows where exactly I am. You know, no one knows exactly where we are right now, except you guys. We didn't tell anybody, hey, we're going to Salzburg. I didn't tweet about it. Did you?
Yeah, I didn't tweet. Hmm. My phone isn't even really on. It hasn't been on the entire time I've been in Europe, as far as the networks I've gone.
My phone might have ratted on me, actually, because I did turn my phone on before. So my phone might know, and it might have told Google. So Google might know we're here. But I don't think any of my friends know that I'm here. I don't think.
Yeah, I might have searched on Google Maps. Shame on me. I guess OpenStreetMaps is something I need to start using or something. But one of the things you touched on is peer pressure, and I really think that's it. Whether it is these services or devices too, because it's the same thing. The services are convenient. The devices are too. And what you're talking about is the Internet of Things. You're talking about hardware too. And what that is just an extension of a lot of the services. Devices like Nest, it's a piece of hardware, but it's Wi-Fi, right? And Google now owns it, but it is going to tell a lot more just by virtue of the components on that device about, you know, your house, when you walk by the thermostat, things like that, little things like that. It's convenient, it's great, the technology itself, but it is so convenient that you're kind of not, you're giving up, you're not realizing how much more information, if someone was interested, they could glean from it. And it really is peer pressure when you see people with, oh, this cool thing, this cool device and all that, and, you know, wow, I want to be able to do that, and I can control this from here and there and the other place. But I guess where I'm really inspired and the kind of peer pressure I want to see is those young people saying, I don't use that service, or look what I built. This is a microcontroller. They're really cheap now. You know, learn some code, build stuff. People are lazy. People want to just, oh yeah, you know what? In fact, we've dealt with this in development, you know, working on a site, you know, you're doing actual stuff to upgrade some stuff. Developers, administrators, they love throwing the easy thing in there. Well, oh, you know, you should have done this. It's way easier, blah, 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 blah. That is a load of crap. And it is abject laziness. So the same thing happens when your friend gets this device or your family says, oh, why don't you just buy a Fitbit so that you can keep track of your health, you know? Maybe I don't want to keep track of every footstep or every of my pulse, of my overall vital signs. And the point is, the movements, the people that are proud of the things they're building, and they get to design and build things themselves, and that is power. Because you're absolutely in control of how it works. You can repair it when it breaks. You understand exactly what it will tell and how it will tell things. And you're not paying for it. You're not paying someone else to lock you out of it and design obsolescence. You know, it'll fall apart at a certain, you know, point because it's past its expiration date and you have to get the new, crud phone 5 or whatever. You know, it is that engineering, that kind of everyday building, that will, I think, be the antidote. And that's the best hope we can see, is the people that aren't lazy, that they'll go, and as we stated, they'll hack, they'll go the extra mile, they'll implement it themselves. If we need, you know, some lighting under the desk here, or we don't just buy it, right? Because that's wasteful. You're looking for someone else to have created a product that is the solution, and you'll pay a premium for that. But I have got to tell you, there are microcontrollers, there are GPS receivers, baseband receivers, accelerometers. Cameras are components. They're not devices anymore. It's a component. It's like a resistor. It's like a capacitor. These things are pieces off the shelf you can put together yourself. You don't need to necessarily buy it from someone. And I think communicating the empowerment, getting people excited about creating objects, creating solutions to how they're going to turn their temperature on their house, doing it themselves, creating your own security system, I think that's the freeing part, and that's, I guess, what we can aspire for the most. And to me, it's the antidote to basically what has become the next level of consumerism, okay? It's, you know, just as cruddy as all the plastic stuff we bought in the 80s and 90s, the stuff that was injection molded, all the crappy toys and stuff that used to be made out of wood and, you know, handcrafted by people, all of that consumerism where people just buy stuff off the shelf is basically being extended into a bunch of people that, if you've watched Silicon Valley, if you see them down there in California pitching their venture capital. It's all garbage. You go to CES, half of that stuff is crap. Nobody's going to use it. They all just want to make a quick buck. They want to think that they have come up with the golden goose of technology. And the point is, that's not it. We all can buy components. We all can learn to solder. We can all build stuff and fix things and solve problems on our own. We don't need to just buy stuff. And that basically is what's happening, is you are getting services connected to objects that are basically the same as any other form of consumerism you've had in the past.
Well, I think that was a lot of interesting insights.
I hope that answers your question.
Well, I think it's a very big question, but yeah, that was a new way of approaching the issue.
Well, it's an exciting time, and we can get very cynical, and there's a lot of kind of dark aspects to it. We have to be excited. To be excited, and that's when we are able to meet with people. We see people putting stations together. We see people running events, and you know, young people getting really excited about building stuff. We really just have to hope that they get around the right circles of people where they're not just creating products for an old model, an old system that has historical precedence. We've seen a lot of this before.
It's important to remain positive, as Kyle is saying, because if you become dark, if you become negative, that's going to reflect in everything you do. It's going to reflect in the people around you, and you're not going to win. We have to keep our sense of humor, even in times that we feel are perilous and threatening and scary, because that is our strength, is being able to see the positive and build something better. So, yeah, you know, regardless of what it is that happens with whatever is occurring in the future, technology-wise, how hackers are being demonized, whatever, we're going to try to remain positive about it, and we're going to keep participating and playing the game and not giving up on it, because that is the only way you win, is by paying attention and by being there.
And asking all the right questions, being critical of yourself, but at the same time acknowledging the importance of being as positive as you can, and being as vital and teaching as much as you're learning and spreading that knowledge, because there are so many other generations coming up that have a lot to offer, and as hackers, I think we have to lead. We have to be able to show by example what is important and what is the real essence of solving these problems. So,
yeah. Okay. Can I ask you just very quickly to introduce yourself in a couple of sentences? I will put it in the edit and put it in the beginning.
Yes. My name is Emmanuel Goldstein. I'm the editor of 2600 Magazine, The Hacker Quarterly, which is a quarterly publication about computer hacking that's been coming out since 1984. I also work in radio and am one of the organizers of the Hackers on Planet Earth conference held every 2 years in New York City.
My name is Kyle. I'm a staff photographer and artist with 2600 Magazine. I also help co-coordinate the HOPE conferences and basically do as much radio and traveling as Emmanuel has, and basically continue to learn and share what we've learned with others. You better kneel down and pray. Oh, la, 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 la.
As good as we did before, we don't smell as good, we are foul to the core. Our flesh may be moldy, but our spirits are free. So let this ghost ship set sail and fly overseas. Get away.
Sommer von Moop Mama und ich habe hier gerade einen neuen Job angefangen in der Radiofabrik auf 107,5 MHz. Jetzt muss ich weiter schuften.
Hey kids, Finn with you, Finn's Revolution, until the 9 p.m. hour. Tonight, Stony Brook Film Festival director Alan Inkles will be with us, giving away some tickets to opening night and closing night and previewing the great Stony Brook Film Festival, which starts this Thursday. Then after that, we're going to celebrate a little bit of Bastille Day, so start cooking up those freedom fries right here at WUSB Stony Brook. Yeah, and just about an hour from now, we're going to give away some tickets to see Jonathan Edwards on the 17th out at the Stephen Talkhouse, so stay tuned for that. But right now, we're going to be joined by Alan Inkles of the Stony Brook Film Festival, which starts this Thursday right here on campus, and a great, great, great event. Let's hear from Alan, and we're going to give away some tickets, too. Alan Inkles, as always, thank you for joining us on Finn's Revolution on WUSB Stony Brook. It's great to have you here.
My pleasure. This is my. I look forward to it every single year.
And this is really the kickoff to the Stony Brook Film Festival, which we're always excited to be seeing. And you have another great, great lineup this year. I was checking it out online. And tell us a little about what's going on this year.
Yeah, it's our 20th anniversary, and mm-hmm. what we're really delighted about is...
It's the 20th anniversary?
20th year, can you believe it?
I cannot believe it.
20 years. I'm going to do a little thing on stage and ask our audience if they remember who our first guest was in the first year. And we'll do it here. We can actually do this and see if people know, and they will offer some free tickets if they can.
Possibly we will. We won't give it away now, but we'll ask.
That's it. But we'll see if anyone was there since the first year. The big thing this year is Island Federal Credit Union, who's been came on board in a big way for the university, supporting the athletics, supporting the vets home, business school, and Staller. They came up with a very nice gift, a 10-year commitment, which we hope will be even longer than that, of course. So it gave us some extra funding to go out and try and bring more filmmakers in, which we've done. I'm really excited about this year. Some great foreign films, but even more so this year, I think the most American independent films we've had in a long time. And I really worked hard to try and do that, get some American films. Because the hardest thing to find are really good American films, because as we've said in the past, they get bought up. You know, there are a lot of people working for Harvey Weinstein and, other companies that are out there looking for these great films. So once they get them, it's tough to screen it here because they've already had a life. We want to premiere them. So I think this year is another great mix. And I say it probably every year because that's what I do. But I really think this year features and shorts are the strongest crop of films we've had in our 20 years.
Yeah, as you said, I was looking at the website, which you guys can also check out at Stony Brook Film Festival, those words, .com, and scope out the vast selection of films. And it's always a great selection, but this year is particularly hot. 20 years, Alan, it's unbelievable. 20 years of screening films to decide.
Yeah,
now, we always talk about this every year. But, I mean, and the process has changed for you in terms of the way you get films.
Yeah.
How did you manage to narrow it down to these films this year?
Yeah, I will say Kent Marks, who's my contract administrator, who came on board about 3-4 years ago, sort of grooming him. Good film, loves film, big background in film. He's a music guy, but which has been helpful for a lot of things in music, too. But he came on board almost by accident on our staff, one of our people left, and he was someone that was on campus, and we interviewed him. He's been helping me look at some films the last couple of years, and I really felt by this year he really had got a real sense of A, what we were looking for, what our audience, you know, I made him watch the audience each night, because that's a big thing, too. Sit
sure.
There, you know, he's seen the films already. So this year, he was a big help. I have to say that I'm always saying every year I'm watching 700 films, and I've got my team that help look at it. But I would say probably we got about 700 entries in. Kent was very helpful in screening some films that really were not needed to be screened, because, you know, like the one that comes in every year for five years and isn't gotten any better.
Right.
And we were able to bounce things off each other, so he was very helpful. But I'm still sitting watching 600-700 films, shorts, features. You know, I get a lot of get sent in from sales agents. We've made a lot of good contacts over the years because we're good to them. We treat our filmmakers right. We put them up right. We make sure we wine and dine them. I reach out to distributors afterwards. Actually, this year we have a few distributors coming out. IFC's coming out to look at some films.
Oh, nice.
I'm waiting on Open Road. Maybe one or two other distributors will come out and look at the films. Even if they don't come out, I will write to them and tell them how great the film was or how good a response it was.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, between that and people have heard about us, you know, after 20 years, it's, you know, you're sort of over the radar screen a little bit and people send films in. And then there's a couple of films I'll read about that I've been following for months and months, and then I, you know, see maybe it played Sundance, maybe it hasn't played anywhere yet, and I'll write to. So those still are the same three ways of getting it. The contacts I know that send me films, or they'll send me a list, and I'll go through and say, look, I don't need to see these four because they're not a cup of tea. Send me these eight films. And then, you know, there's, I would say, looking at their schedule, there's, the shorts are all, they come in on their own. They very rarely request the shorts. So the shorts are all sort of submissions. But of the 20 or so features, I would say about a third came in that I went after from foreign distributors, a third came in that were submissions on their own, and a third were probably ones that were somewhere in between. I had reached out to them, they had reached out to me, we had a mutual contact, a lot of alumni coming back, or a lot of films connected to alumni.
That okay, that's great, spray, too.
Which is really interesting. Alumni of the festival. Not
right, right,
the
no, I understand. Yeah, and that's the thing, is like after all these years and this great establishment of the festival, and it raising its profile as year after year, it's like a real cachet to be shown at the
Look, it's you know, we're not Sundance in Toronto and Canada.
Well, right.
At a certain level, it's not a market where people flock into and go skiing in the day and see movies at night. But we're, you know, the quality of the films are amazing. I look at other festivals, big ones, you know, Rhode Island or Nantucket, and I look at films that I turn down. You know, we're not about quantity. We've said that before, too. It's really about,
yeah,
we've got a big screen. It's a 40-foot screen. It's summer. It's Long Island. It's July. People do not want to spend 12 hours a day in the movie. They already yell at me for spending 4 hours a night. Then I come right back at them and say, I've spent 6 hours a night for 5 months watching them. You can sit through two features and two shorts. We push joke about it. It's all a lot of fun. But the quality is great. It's got to be. I've got a 40-foot screen. I've got a very discerning audience. These people, you know, want to come. I get people come to me at the end of the year and say, I loved every film. And I said, you know, go get checked. You know, I mean, they're really good, but I mean, they're all different. I mean, but I think what it does, it really opens up the door for a lot of people. You buy a very inexpensive pass. You come to films you might normally not see, and you come out and say, wow, I really like foreign language films, or these Dutch films are really great, or I wouldn't normally gone to see this sort of kind of film, but I stuck with it and I really liked it. You know, we do a little experimental, a little challenging films, but by and large, my audience likes a good narrative story, and that's really what the festival has really become. It's giving you really good stories that are independent, that are from the heart of filmmakers, that
mm-hmm.
are really touching or funny or, you know, challenging.